Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang gunutarang upacayang namasami.
Well, I'm very happy to have this opportunity to meet with all of you again this evening. It's almost exactly 2 years since I was here last time. And I almost didn't make it today because, I won't go into all that, but finally got here. And it's exciting times, I think, for the Buddhist community in this part of the world. And tomorrow we'll be having a called a papa offering, and students of mine and people from all over the place have been making donations to support Pacific Hermitage. So people in Bangkok and in Korat, in Thailand, in Ubon, and in LA and in San Francisco, and so news of your project is being spread far and wide, and many people are very interested and inspired by what's happening here. So I know that Buddhist communities in Western countries, even with the internet and the enhanced communications that we are blessed with these days, can still feel rather isolated and not really perhaps so much part of a larger Buddhist world. So one of my intentions is coming here this time was to let you know that as far away as Thailand, there are many people who are following this project with interest and even enthusiasm. So this evening, it's my pleasure to be able to share some thoughts on the Dhamma with all of you. And in Thailand, I've seen, of course, huge changes in the 32, 33 years that I've been there. And at least in terms of the Buddhist dimension to life in Thailand, I've seen many very encouraging things taking place, particularly in the last few years. There's a huge interest in meditation, particularly amongst the urban middle class, which was not the case when I was first in Thailand. And one piece of anecdotal evidence that I could cite of general interest is that over the past few years, many FM radio stations have been set up throughout the country, and in almost every district, every province, there are Buddhist monasteries running radio stations, and with like 24-hour Dhamma talks and chanting and sometimes questions and answers. fueled largely by a huge production of CDs, Dhamma talks being produced for free distribution and being able to be used by these stations. And whereas a few years ago, if you went out on alms round or walking through the countryside, you'd hear the sound of pop music on these tinny little radios that people carry around with them as they look after their water buffaloes or do their work in the fields. And these days you're much more likely to hear the sound of monks giving Dhamma talks or even chanting. This is something I've experienced many times. So there's a lot to feel optimistic about. One change that I've noticed in particular is when I was first teaching many, many years ago now, mostly the people who would come would be elderly, and they would, a common question would be, how can we get our children to become interested in the Dhamma? Now, these days, I get more and more younger people coming saying, how can we get our parents interested in the Dhamma? So I'm not sure whether that's a sign of progress or decline. Anyway, one common attitude which still prevails is that Dhamma practice is for later years, after you've fulfilled all your responsibilities as a householder and you've put your children through school and college and you have a little bit more free time. And very commonly, usually men rather than women will say, you know, I don't do bad things. I lead a reasonably good kind of life. I'm just not ready yet to practice the Dhamma. And so one of my replies to this kind of statement is that's not the choice that you have to make, because the moment you wake up in the morning, you are starting to practice, meaning you are creating karma through body, speech, and mind, and you continue to do that until you fall asleep at night. And that is practice. The creation of karma through body, speech, and mind is practice. So it's not a choice between practicing or not practicing, postponing practice to some time in the future. The choice is what you are practicing, whether you're practicing Dhamma or you're practicing Adhamma, which means all those things which are not Dhamma. There isn't some kind of middle ground or neutral space where you can just kind of dwell in a kind of a neutral gear until you can move into some really serious practice sometime in the future. And the Buddha said that every time that we act, and action here in this sense includes volitional thought and speech as well as physical action, is meaningful. It has results and consequences. And that if the mind is not inclining towards what is wholesome, then it will incline to what is unwholesome. So the Buddha is really teaching us to take responsibility for our lives and for the quality of our actions. And one of the ways in which the Lord Buddha referred to his teaching was to categorize it. There are many different kinds of religious traditions prevalent at that time in India. We can say it was a golden age for religions. And they were categorized, and one of the categories that the Buddha said applied to his teaching was that it is a viryavada teaching. So it's a teaching of virya. It's a teaching of effort. It's a teaching that effort is possible, effort has results, and that we fulfill ourselves as Buddhists and as human beings through action, through wise action. So I would suggest that for that reason, Buddhism is a universal religion. Why I say that is that I like to speak of religions as forming themselves into families, and the group of religions, the monotheistic religions that grew up in the Middle East, Judaism, Christianity, Islam, are a family of religions, and they are characterized essentially by faith. They are belief systems. And so in this culture, we tend to look at all religions as belief systems. If we do that, we seriously misunderestimate the teaching of the Buddha. Now, that any belief system is always going to have problems when it comes into contact with conflicting belief systems. For people who are adherents of any particular belief system, then they find themselves in a quandary. If you believe that your ultimate happiness is dependent most importantly or exclusively on what you believe, then what is the correct way to relate to people who don't believe or have different beliefs? And this is, of course, part of the background to the various religious wars and conflicts that we have seen over the past 2,000 years, and to the general consensus that any religion, when it finds itself in the ascendancy and it has political and social power, will tend to oppress religions in the minority, and therefore education systems, for instance, need to be secular in order to be fair and to prevent that kind of conflict. Now, my contention is that Buddhism is not a belief system. I think one very simple test would be to pick up a copy of the Majjhima Nikaya or any of the major discourse collections of the Buddha, and at random read a page and then compare it with a page from any of the holy scriptures in the faith traditions. Quite a different thing altogether. So the belief systems, no matter how benign the teachings of each faith belief system may be, are, I would argue, inherently divisive. Whereas the Buddha's teaching says that your welfare and your ultimate happiness does not depend largely or exclusively on what you believe. It depends on what you do, on the quality of your actions, the quality of your speech, the way that you use your mind. And so there's no difficulty at all as Buddhists for us to acknowledge the fact that a Christian, after death in this lifetime, could be reborn in heaven, or a Muslim, or a Jew, or a Zoroastrian, or a shaman, or an atheist. Their particular belief systems are not the main energy driving rebirth. It's what we do, how we act. So the Buddhist teaching is one of action. Now, I have I would like to share with you a somewhat perhaps an arrogant idea that I think that I can bring all the religions of the world together. And my reason for this assertion is that I think that we've started off, or we've been working from the top downwards, and it doesn't work. You know, when they have all these interfaith meetings, and the main idea is, well, we're all really doing the same things, we're all really aspiring towards the same things, we have the same values, we just call them different words, and really it's all the same. And, you know, it's kind of friendly, it has certain social benefits. But of course, if I was to ask, well, do you actually know that? You know, do you know that heaven and nibbana and paramatman and all these things are actually the same thing under different names? Or do you just think that's a kind of a diplomatic and friendly way of talking about different traditions? So I would argue it doesn't work, because everybody says that, but in their heart of hearts they say, but really my religion is the best. So my idea is, instead of starting at the top, you start at the bottom. So what's the bottom? And this is to make this fundamental and seriously important distinction between believing something and knowing something. It's surely not a difficult concept to grasp that it is possible for a human being to believe completely, utterly, absolutely in something which is completely false. We've seen this again and again and again throughout history. From my own life, I had an absolute, unwavering faith in Santa Claus at one period in my life. So the idea that the intensity and strength of your faith is a proof of what you believe in is obviously a fallacy. So in Buddhism, we have this wonderful word, satchanuraka, which means caring for the truth. And you care for the truth by making a clear distinction between what you believe and what you actually know. So if we let's just assume this might, or imagine perhaps that this might happen, that we had all these wise people come together, and one person says, I believe that Jesus died to save me from my sins, but I don't actually know that. It's my belief. And a Muslim says, I don't really know either, but I believe that Muhammad was the prophet of God. So everybody has to start off with this very simple, humble acknowledgement that they don't actually know anything about what they're talking about. So instead of, you know, we actually know that we're all talking about the same thing, we're all going the same place, which is responsible for I don't know how many hundreds of hours of waffle. Let's just start and say we don't actually know. So if you're a Buddhist and say, oh, you're a Buddhist, you believe in reincarnation, don't you? You know, don't fall into that trap. You know, Buddhism's not a religion of dogmas. You don't have to sign on for certain beliefs when you become Buddhist, but you're taught to understand the nature of belief. So if my answer would be, you're a Buddhist monk, you know, you must believe in rebirth. I say, well, I don't actually have any direct experience of rebirth. I don't have that knowledge of past lives personally. So I'm starting off in a position I don't know. But I believe in it. I have a strong belief in rebirth. And these are the reasons. Firstly, because of all the evidence in the suttas, in the discourses of the Buddha. Secondly, the past life memories of experienced meditators who I've spoken to personally. Thirdly, spontaneous memories of past lives from children throughout the world, many of them very well documented. And fourthly, memories of past lives under hypnosis. Now, I think that those are four very strong supports for a belief in rebirth, but they're not a proof of it. So I think this is, a way that we can relate to each other, which is a lot more real and ultimately constructive than the idealistic way that is being pursued mainly at the present. So can we accept that we don't actually know? So going back to point of effort, I'd like to just point tell you a story. It's one of my favorite stories and concerns two frogs. And these two frogs live by a pond, and you know, it's a pretty monotonous life, a lot of croaking and a lot of sort of froggy activities. And then one day one of the frogs says, "Let's go and look in the cow shed. We've never been there, but there's some very interesting sounds come out of there sometime, and it kind of looks a cool place." So I say, "Yeah, okay." Now the lady, the farm, had just gone into the cow shed to milk the cows. She's got this big pitcher of milk, and she just put it down when she heard her baby crying. So she was very concerned about her baby, rushed off, and left the pitcher of milk there on a shelf. The frogs come in and say, "What's?" And they sort of see the cows, a little bit intimidating, little bit smelly, so we'll leave them. And they see this pitcher of milk and say, what's that?" So they jump up onto the top, and it's sort of kind of white and watery and interesting. So they jump down, and of course they can't get out again. And so what can they do? They're struggling, and they start to swim. And one of them, he's the Ajahn, and he's very, he's not panicked at all. But his student is really panicking at this point. And so he wasn't a I don't think he was a Theravada frog, because he taught his student a song, and we're not allowed to do that. But I'll reproduce it for documentary evidence anyway. He had this song, and he said, "Look, just sing this song." And he said, "Little," and he said, "Never give up, never give up. However long the day, never give up until you find the way." So he starts swimming and swimming, and he goes, "I can't do it anymore, I can't do it anymore." He says, "Never give up, never give up. However long the day, never give up until you find the way." But this frog is getting more and more. He's less and less inspired by this song. And eventually there's a glug, glug, glug. And there's only one frog left now. But this frog, he just never gives up, never gives up. And he's swimming around and around and around and around and around. And suddenly, well, not suddenly, after a long time, actually, he only feels something under his, a little bit solid under his feet. He said, "Oh, no, that's not the corpse of my dear friend and disciple." No, it wasn't. It was something else. What could that be? It was butter. He'd swam and swam and swam and swam until he churned the milk into butter, and suddenly had a new surge of energy. And he swam and swam and he sang this song, never give up, never give up, have a long the day, never give up, till you find the way. And then the butter increased and he was able to use its steps and escape. So it's the teaching of effort and virya. Before I came to the States, I was in Bhutan, and I told this story to a group of 300-400 school children. And all the schooling in Bhutan is done in English. And these children, even though they came from quite poor backgrounds, their English was very good. And it was so cool, you know, because I just once through on this verse, and they could all join in. Okay. So all I had to say was, never give up. And then there's 300-400 children, never give up, never give up. And it was really sweet. And then at the end, there was questions. And so people asked questions about the story. And then this one little girl came up. No, it was a boy, actually. And one little boy came up, and she said, what happened to the baby? And that moment I realized, you know, how stories develop, because, you know, I couldn't say, well, she's not really important, you know. So, you know, I had to make up. So I said, the lady, she walked back into the farmhouse and she picked up her baby. And she said, even though I went away, I never forgot about you, even for a single second. And the baby didn't understand what she was saying because she was just a baby, but she saw the look in her mummy's eyes and felt the warmth of her mummy's arms, and she knew my mummy loves me very much. And everyone said, ah. So, that was the story. Now, having told the story, I'll carry on. And tell you a little bit my idea about practice and what practice is. So I feel that the teaching of Sammāvāyāma, which is the fifth element in the Eightfold Path, as I'm sure most of you will be aware, is the best, most comprehensive framework for Dhamma practice. So getting away from the idea of practice is sitting in a particular posture, walking, doing this, doing that. Saying practice is in any situation that we find ourselves, whether it's in a monastery or in the marketplace, in a Dhamma center, or at home, or in an office, our effort is to protect the mind from unwholesome dhammas which have not yet arisen. And because it's highly unlikely or impossible that you'll be able to do that in every case, then also at the appropriate times, applying effort to reduce, to let go of, to eliminate unwholesome dhammas that have already arisen. The third kind of effort is bringing into the mind wholesome dhammas which have not yet arisen. And fourth, and very importantly, is not becoming heedless and satisfied with wholesome dhammas that have already arisen, but seeking to develop them further. And after the Buddha's enlightenment, speaking of the two virtues which were most instrumental in his enlightenment experience, he cited two. First is unremitting effort, and secondly was discontent with the results, with the kusala dhammas, which he had already realized. You know, if you can imagine, Prince Siddhartha left the palace and studied with the two greatest meditation teachers around. His progress was miraculous. Both teachers said, you know more than us now. One invited him to be a co-teacher or a co-abbot, and the other one said, you can just run the whole show. And the Prince Siddhartha must obviously have developed incredibly strong samadhi, and that kind of samadhi suppresses almost all of the defilements. You're not experiencing that kind of agitation, ups and downs. Like good samadhi, firm, stable samadhi of that level, it feels subjectively like you're enlightened. That's why so many people overestimate their attainments. So, incredibly, given the fact that even the ajahn, even the authority figure, is saying, you've done it, you know, you've realized it, there's something in Prince Siddhartha that said, no, there's something more. And that was a quality that the Buddha recommended for all of us, and is saying that we should be content with a reasonable amount, an optimum amount of material sustenance. And we should be constantly checking and looking and asking ourselves, what is the optimum amount in material realm? But in the spiritual realm, we should be discontent. It's meaning saying, no, this is not enough. We need to go further, because if you're not going further, you're going to decline. In the monastic world, we see many monks, or at least a number of monks, who disrobe, so in their 40s, and one of the reasons, other than sort of midlife crisis kind of reason, is that they reach a certain level of samadhi, of inner peace, and assume that it's stable, and take it for granted, and then find themselves unable to cope with the distress that arises when, for one reason or another, through ill health or through a change in lifestyle, it appears quite clearly to have been only an impermanent condition. So an analogy that I've come up with this is a glass of water with some germs in it. If you want to kill the germs, you have to boil the water at 100 degrees. Now, if you were to heat that water up to 95 degrees, 96, 97 degrees Celsius, or I don't know what that is in Fahrenheit, 200 and something Fahrenheit, the water would be extremely hot. And the difference between that hot water and boiling water would be quite small, but it would be a crucial difference, because unless the water reached the boiling point, then the germs wouldn't die. And when the water cooled down for some reason or other, you'd be no better off than you were before. And similarly, the stream entry is the point at which the water boils, as it were, to mix metaphors somewhat, but I hope that you'll understand what I mean. So there's these four kinds of effort, and the particular techniques that one is employing to guard the mind against unwholesome dhammas, to eliminate unwholesome dhammas to have arisen, to bring up, to instill wholesome dhammas that are not yet arisen, and to care for, protect, and to increase the power of wholesome. These will vary greatly, and there are some that are extremely important. Of course, mindfulness being the main one, but you need a whole medley of techniques and the skill to apply them appropriately. I was speaking with someone this morning, and say a teacher in a school in the Bay Area, And she was saying how difficult it is to teach restraint to teenagers in America. I said, well, not just in America and not just teenagers, but the point being, I'm saying that often choice of vocabulary, the word that you use, can elicit a strong emotional reaction, which prevents people from hearing the rationale or the value of doing so. And I say, for instance, with sense restraint, in Thailand, I would teach of children to care for their eyes, care for their ears. You know, apart from the physical care of eyes and ears, how do you care for sight? How do you care for hearing, so that it isn't a cause of suffering for you? And I also love to quote Chekhov. And Chekhov, the Russian writer and playwright, once wrote a letter to a friend, and he said, "I'm sorry to have written such a very long letter. I didn't have enough time to write a short one." And so if we look at restraint as editing, you know, so it's not like there's something you really want and you're just sort of not going to do it because you think it wouldn't be a good thing or one reason or another. But if you look at it, any great piece of prose writing or any art, it's what you leave out as much as what you put in, which creates its unique quality and value. And I'm saying in life and in conduct, it's as much what you don't do as what you do do that gives your life integrity and value, and makes can make your life a source of blessings to others rather than the opposite. So these are four areas, and sense restraint is one of the traditional formulations of this practice of taking care of the sense bases as a way of preventing unwholesome dhammas from arising. Time doesn't really permit me to go into this in great detail this evening, but I would like to give you a further set of four as a pair with these four right efforts, as we call them. This is, I think the last time I came, I explained somewhat my idea and how I'm teaching and propagating the concepts of a Buddhist education or Buddhist wisdom education, and expressing it in terms of four kinds of cultivation or development. These are in Pali, Kaya Pavana, Sila Pavana, Jitta Pavana, and Banya Pavana. One of the reasons, one of my teachers and a great theorist of we call this Buddhist education, uses the threefold training or education of Sila, Samadhi, and Banya as the underpinning for a so-called Buddhist or Buddhist wisdom education. I decided to use these four pavana because speaking with many parents who are not yet familiar with this concept, you talk about samadhi and people think immediately just going to have my kid sitting with his eyes closed all day, he may be very peaceful, but he's not going to be able to survive in the real world, that kind of idea. So taking a second group of dhammas from the sutta, which cover the same ground but are expressed slightly differently and I think more appropriately for an education system generally, but I think also useful reflections for Dhamma practitioners everywhere. So Gaya Pavana means a cultivation of your relationship to the physical world. So that would begin with your physical body and be concerned with effort to find a balance, an optimum quality for the amount, the kind of food you eat, the amount of exercise you get, and the generally how you treat your physical body, how much rest you give your body, for instance. And then if you can imagine like concentric circles from your physical body, which is the aspect of the material universe you're most intimate with, the outside to your possessions. And what's the optimal, wise relationship to your all the things that you call mine, whether it's your house, your car, your computer, what's your relationship to the internet, to Facebook, and all these kinds of things? Is it in that level? It's the optimum amount, meaning to say it is conducive to development in Dhamma. It's not an obstacle to it. The outer circle would be your relationship to the environment. That's the first area. The second area, external area, is your relationship to the social world and finding a way of relating to people in your own family and in the community and society in which you live, in which you are acting and speaking in such ways that you are preventing the arising of unwholesome dhammas that have not yet arisen, reducing, eliminating unwholesome dhammas that have arisen, bringing forth good qualities that have not yet arisen, and caring for and developing further good qualities that have arisen. So these are the external two external. We're dividing sila into one, your relationship to the material world, the second, your relationship to the social world, the social universe in which you live. Internally, the division of the citta and banya. So here we're using, instead of samadhi, we're using citta, the heart. In sila, samadhi, banya, the threefold training, that the samadhi there does not refer exclusively to samadhi instead of inner stability and clarity of mind. It's the element of that training which is given a special place, the place of honor. Or if you in a more worldly or mundane sphere, if you have a big band and a very charismatic singer, then usually just refer to it by the name of the singer, and you know that includes the whole band. So samadhi includes all the band of kusala dhammas. There's too many to name. So using citta is, I think, a little bit clear-cut. So how are we to live our lives, how are we to put forth effort in a way to prevent the arising of hindrances and defilements, to reduce, eliminate those that have already arisen, to give rise to wholesome dhammas, and to care for and develop those that have already arisen. So you can see that whereas a certain amount of interpretation and explanation may be needed in terms of the first two, in the citta pavana, that's very clear cut. It's like you're doing that in a very direct and obvious way. With the development of the fourth banya, then we're talking mainly three levels of banya. First, thinking, basic thinking skills, critical, creative thinking, being able to use the mind with a certain amount of discipline and logic. Second level is yoniso manasikara, the ability to reflect wisely on experience. And the highest level of wisdom would be vipassana. This is a clear, non-discursive, direct experience of the three characteristics, the way things are. So putting effort to prevent those mental qualities which undermine wisdom or prevent wisdom faculty from being employed effectively, from arising, eliminating those obstacles to it that have already arisen, finding ways to support the arising and the employment of wisdom when and how it's needed, and the effort to further cultivate the wisdom faculty, particularly in the areas of yoni-soma-manasikara and vipassana, or clear seeing. So so I'm saying, rather than looking in terms of, oh, I don't have so much time to sit these days, but I try to be a bit mindful in daily life and so on, then I'm suggesting this, looking at your practice in terms of these four efforts and looking in those four different focuses for those four efforts. And I think that will be the end of my talk this evening. So thank you for your patience. And
Andamayang Dhammakachaya Sadhu Karam Dhammase
Sadhu Sadhu.